So we're going to go to a well-known gospel story. Actually, it's Luke 18, 9 to 14. But it's kind of a connection of, and many of you who are in, whatever you want to call, mainline churches probably had this reading recently in the liturgies and services. But it has concepts of Old Testament law and New Testament grace. Because as you know, it compares two men that approach God very differently. And when you're living in a covenant of law, you approach God much differently than when you live in a covenant of grace. Because instead of thinking about the scorecard, you think about mercy and grace and forgiveness. And we're going to see an example of two guys from Luke's gospel who show this contrast, but it also applies to our everyday living. When you think about, I'm so awesome and I'm so good, and, you know, compared to that guy over there, man, I'm really good. I've never killed anybody. I've never done any of these terrible things. And boy, that poor schmuck over there, look at all the stuff he's done. Schmuck, of course, is Yiddish, so it wasn't around yet. It wasn't in the original languages. But anyway, it'd be a few hundred years later. But let's read we'll read the whole passage first, then we'll kind of jump into it. So this is verse 9. Also, he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves. Look who he's speaking to. Others who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified, rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. This is pretty straightforward, right? This, you can understand this just by reading it. You know, a lot of the parables are tough to understand. And, you know, sometimes the disciples even say to Jesus, what does this mean? And then he explains it to them. This one's pretty straightforward, but let's start back at the beginning. Who is this aimed at? It says people who trusted in themselves. People who trust in themselves and trust in their plans. You know, we make a plan for something, and then we present it to God for him to bless it. Right? Isn't that what most people do? Even churches do that. We make a plan, then we say, here it is, Lord. Here's the plan we made up. So if you just put your blessing on it, we'll just go get started. Instead of asking the Holy Spirit, what should our plan be, and waiting for inspiration. So it's aimed at people who trust in themselves. Now, this man and many people that are in this group trust in their own righteousness. Because everybody knows that there's 10 commandments. And if you just kind of, you know, look through them really quick, you say, I don't do any of that stuff. And I used to talk to young people at the office, mostly drug reps, and like I said, you guys I didn't have to talk to because you guys were already on board. But and Vince just came to have cheesecake. But that was my day. And Diet Coke, yeah. We never went a day without food there. I don't know if you guys ever got any food, but oh man. You made your appointments at the wrong time. But I forgot what I was going to say. But I would witness to people, you know, the reps and the salespeople, and they would say, "Well, I'm really good. I go to church most of the time. I take care of my kids. I do my job. I'm really good." And I say, "Gee, have you ever used the Lord's name in vain?" "Well, yeah, sometimes I have." "Oh," I said, "have you ever committed adultery?" "Oh, no." But I say, "Well, you know, Jesus said if you look at a woman with lust, you've committed adultery without doing the act." I said, "Did you ever look at a woman with lust?" And they'd go, "Well..." I'd say, "Never?" "Well, sometimes I have." "Did you ever steal anything?" "Well, just, you know, minor stuff. Took a box of paper clips, you know, from the office, or took some pens that didn't belong to me." So I'd say, "Well, okay, let's see what we have so far. You're a blasphemer, an adulterer, and a thief. So you're not off to a really good start. So you're not as holy as you think that you are." But they trust in their own righteousness, and they convince themselves that they're good. Right? And you are relatively good. I mean, let's face it. You know, we could be other places on Friday night, right, rather than here. We could be other places on Saturday morning or Sunday morning rather than being in a church. So we're, you know, relatively good. But this guy's convinced that he's good. Many people are convinced that they're good, and they despise others as inferior. Look at that guy over there. If I was doing the stuff he's doing, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. I'm better than that. I happen to know that that guy did such and such a thing last February. So I heard about it. They despise others. So that's who this is addressed to. So you see where he's going with this when he's going to describe these two guys. The Pharisees. Who were the Pharisees? They were highly educated, formed and trained in the religion, studied the scriptures. I mean, that's basically what they did, was study the law. Right? The teachers of the law, Jesus called them. And that's not an insult to be a teacher of the law, because the law comes from God. They were teachers of the law. They were, in Hebrew, they're called the parashim, which means the set-apart ones. They're set apart from everybody else because they're holy, because they do the stuff, as John Wimber used to say. They do the stuff. And those, you know, those people over there, they're not doing the stuff. I don't see them carrying Torah scrolls around, studying night and day. I don't see them on their computers doing Bible study. I don't see them sitting in the family room reading their scrolls. They don't. Maybe they come on Saturday morning, but sometimes they don't. We're there every day, not just on Saturday. We're there all the time. This is what the Pharisees were. And they kind of made themselves the set-apart ones. You know, God didn't come down and say, "You guys are the set-apart ones because you're so awesome." They made this out of their own holiness, their own righteousness, their own awesomeness. And so they considered themselves the holy ones. Paul was a Pharisee, right? When he was Saul of Tarsus. In fact, he calls himself Hebrew of Hebrews, Pharisee of Pharisees. "No one was more zealous for the law than I was," he says. No one. He didn't say I was in the top 10%. He didn't say, "Well, there are three, four guys better than me, but I was right up there." He says, "No one was like me. I did the law stuff. And I knew the law's cold. All 613 of them, I knew every one of them, and I did every one of them. No one's more zealous." So they're confident before God. Because after all, if the covenant is, here's the law, and if you follow this law, you're holy. If you don't, you're not. And you convince yourself that you're following the law, you're very confident before God. God really likes me now. In fact, he loves me way more than that guy, because I do all the stuff. Jesus said, you know, they make their phylacteries bigger and bigger. You know, phylactery is the Hebrew is tefillim. It's the thing of what that we read in the V'ahavta that says you put the word on your between your eyes and on your hands. So they're just like a little wooden box with leather straps that have that scripture inside of them. But yet the Pharisees made really big ones and really nice, beautiful, long robes. So when you saw them coming, and you're an ordinary guy who's, you know, working for a living out in the street, you said, wow, those guys are the holy ones. Because look, they got that really big thing, and I just got this little dopey one. Look at the size of the one that guy's got. They're the holy ones. Jesus said they like to stand on the street corners and say really long prayers. Because if they say really long prayers, people say, man, those guys are real. This guy's been praying for 15 minutes. He's got to be really holy. And none of the prayers were, God have mercy on me, a sinner. They just went on and on and on with a lot of eloquence. You know, you see some of these older, you know, older days, older guys that were the, you know, the right reverend somebody or other and the very reverend somebody or other or, you know, his eminence somebody or other, you know, and they would say, let us pray. And they would go on for 20 minutes in this beautiful English prayer, very little of which was, oh, God have mercy on me, a sinner, right? Which is one of the earliest prayers of the church. It's called the Jesus Prayer. So they're very confident, and they depend on their own merits. Because I've done all the stuff. I got the rules here, and I do them. That's the deal. So they justify themselves, and they do it proudly. This guy stands there. Jesus says he prays to himself, basically. He talks with himself. God's not listening to him. Because his whole prayer is, hey, God, I know you listen to me because I fast twice a week. I tithe everything. I'm over here praying all the time. I got all this cool stuff on. And I'm not like that guy over there who's looks like a mess and he's standing way in the back. I get to come right up to the front. So God listens to me. So I'm way up here and I keep the law. And regular people don't measure up to the law. This is why they always said to the disciples, how come your master doesn't keep the Sabbath? How come you did stuff on the Sabbath that's unlawful to do? I saw them picking grain. And Yeshua, Jesus, lectures them about that. Says, you know, King David went into the temple and ate the showbread that only the priests were allowed to eat because he and his men were hungry. A priest works on the Sabbath, but he's not defiled because that's his job to work on the Sabbath. But these guys, they had all this law stuff down cold. So they can stand in front. Now, you have to understand that at the temple, you have the Holy of Holies over here, as we talked about for Yom Kippur. So you could go right up to the veil. You couldn't go in it. You could go right up to the veil and say, here I am. And all this week, I've been doing the stuff. They justify themselves, and they do it proudly. They like to be in public. You know, they love the title rabbi. When they go to a wedding, you know, they go sit in the front. They like people in the marketplace saying, oh, here's Rabbi so-and-so. Here's Pharisee so-and-so. Here's the very reverend Pharisee guy. They love that. And they love hearing it in public because people are impressed at their holiness. So when Jesus says, in order for you to be saved, your righteousness has to surpass that of the Pharisees. That sorry bunch of guys he's walking around with are stunned. What do you mean? How can we be holier than the Pharisees? They're the holy ones, the holy ones. We're just dopey. They didn't get that until later. So everybody was impressed. And people applaud their devotion. Oh, look at the nice stuff he's wearing. Oh, look at the nice long prayer he said. Wow. You know, when my mother died, he came to the funeral and, oh, it was great. He said this beautiful prayer. Wow. You got to be a really holy guy to do that. And they want their works to be seen. You know, Jesus said, when you give alms, don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. He says, when you pray, go in your closet. Don't stand on the street corner and pray. And you know what going to the closet means, right? Because we've been at this a long time. It's when you take the tallit, the prayer shawl, and put it over your head. And then you're communicating just with God. It's between you and him. So when you see a man standing with the tallit over his head, he's in his prayer closet. He doesn't want to be bothered. So you don't go up to him and tap him on the shoulder and say, did you see the seventh game of the World Series? Because he's talking personally with God. He doesn't want to be bothered. The Pharisees want their works to be seen. And he says this Pharisee basically prayed with himself. God's not listening to him. He's praying with himself. He's the only one listening to what he's saying. The Greek means it's a reflexive thing. He's praying basically to himself, for himself, you know, in the power of himself. It's a reflexive verb. So he's so convinced of his righteousness that he's just saying out the prayer as if he's saying it to himself. And so God should be impressed too. But unfortunately, the prayer's not going up. It's not a prayer that goes up. And he says, I'm thankful that I'm this way. I'm so glad you made me this way. You know, there's a prayer that Hebrew men say, and I can't remember if it's at night or in the morning, that says, thanks God for not making them a woman. But if you ever read it, in our day it sounds kind of comical, but in those days, of course, they prayed, I'm glad I'm not a woman, because, you know, women were second-class citizens. But he thanks God that he's the way he is, and he's not like this other guy who he's looking at, who's way in the back of the church. So the prayer's not going up. It's hitting the ceiling if it's even going that high. No matter how much incense he burns, the incense, of course, is symbolic of prayers going up. It also covered the smell. The inside of the temple would have been disgustingly smelly with all the animals and sacrifices and blood everywhere. Because sin is messy business. But the incense were the prayers arising. His didn't go up really high. I don't do what other people do. You know, he's self-justified. I've always followed the rules. Like the older brother and the prodigal son, right? This son of yours did all this stuff. I'm here working for you all the time. So I don't want to go to the party. The party should be for me, not for him. And I'm definitely not like that guy. So this other guy, who's typically known as the publican, these guys were despised in biblical times because they worked for the Romans. They were tax collectors. They were customs agents, that kind of thing. In Capernaum, where Jesus spent a big part of his ministry years, it's right on the Sea of Galilee, and there was a customs booth there. So there were government customs people that would collect duties on things as they went through. The Romans hired them, but they were local people. The Romans hired people to collect taxes. And they would say, well, look, here's the deal. We want this much tax, but, you know, if you want, you can charge more. Then you can keep the difference. So that was kind of their payment. And that was their greed, like Zacchaeus. He gave back four times more than he owed. So, you know, he took a lot of money. So the tax collectors were despised because they worked for the oppressors and they extorted people. This doesn't mean, you know, they worked for the IRS and they sat at a desk all day with a computer, and, you know, I don't personally like the IRS, but that's a whole different concept than what they call the tax collector. They're hated by the people. But here's this guy. He's humble and he's repentant. Why? Because he knows he's done wrong. He knows he's not holy. He knows he's not righteous. He knows he's made mistakes. He knows he's taken things that don't belong to him. He knows he's taken money from people that he didn't deserve. He knows he works for the oppressors. You know, in the concentration camps, the Nazis had other Jews who organized the Jews. I forgot what they were called. And there was a derogatory word they were called in Yiddish, and I can't remember what they were called in German. But they were Jews who helped the Nazis organize all the other Jews in the concentration camp. Can you imagine how people would feel about you? This was kind of a similar, well, I shouldn't say similar, but same idea. So he knows he's done wrong. And he keeps his distance. Why? Because this is the holy place. You know, when you study the Torah, that's what you learn, right? The holy things are in the front on the other side of the veil. That's why every church looks like it does. Because this church looks like the tent in the wilderness. It looks like the temple. The holy things are here with the veil. The Holy of Holies is in the back. The people are over there because they can't approach because they're sinners. Nothing unholy can approach God. This is the sin problem. You know, we live in a time where people think, oh, he overlooks everything. He doesn't care about that stuff anymore. Maybe he cared about it 3,000 years ago, but he doesn't care about it now. You know, he didn't forgive Adam and Eve taking a bite of an apple, but I'm sure he's going to overlook all the stuff I've done. Very dangerous thinking. You have very prominent preachers and teachers who now say, hey, nothing matters. Everything's covered by grace. You can do whatever you want during your life. In the end, it's all going to be fine. That's what you call walking on thin ice or skating on thin ice. But he keeps his distance because he doesn't want to go near the holy place because he's not worthy. He knew he was far off from God, and God was in here. He was behind the veil. So he stayed in the back, even farther away than where the coffee was. Even farther away than where the street was. He doesn't want to go near the holy place. And he doesn't even look up. He's so burdened by his sin that he doesn't want to even look up. And he knows that this Pharisee who he can see up in the front is looking at him with scorn. You know, kind of like when you're humble and crushed down by sin and you're repenting and you know that you've done wrong and you don't even want to look up and you see some guy up in the front who's, you know, the bishop or the pope or the whatever the head of whatever is. You say, oh man, he's looking at me like he knows I'm a sinner. I better just stay back here. He knows the Pharisee looks at him with scorn. And he does scorn him by what he says. He's afraid to approach the holy thing. Because you have to be just to go there. You have to be holy to go in the holy place. He wouldn't even lift his eyes. Yet, you know, in Jeremiah, God says these people commit horrible sins and they parade them in front of me. They're not even humbled by it. And the lesson we did about the idolatry says they're like prostitutes. They don't even know how to blush because they've done the same horrible thing so many times. Nothing embarrasses them anymore. You know, their consciences are seared, as Paul says later. He wouldn't even lift his eyes, but he lifted his heart up. And this is the difference between the two. This is the difference between law and grace. The other guy's lifting up his qualifications, his achievements. Knows he's got a good spot on the scorecard. He's certainly in the top 10% of his class. Maybe he's the top one, like Saul of Tarsus thought. This guy doesn't lift his eyes, but he lifts his heart up because he knows he's wrong. Psalm 51. Remember when David wrote Psalm 51? He spent a week fasting and wailing. He didn't eat. He didn't drink anything. He didn't change his clothes. The dude was a mess. And he was the king. And people probably went by and said, Your Majesty, do you think maybe you could take a shower today? You think maybe you could change your clothes? No. For 1 week, he did this because he wanted the baby that was born from Bathsheba to live. The baby died, like the prophet Nathan told him the baby was going to die. But during this time, he writes Psalm 51. I have a humble and contrite heart. My sin is before me always. My sin is before me always. I've done all these horrible things. I didn't only commit adultery with this woman, I had her husband killed. She had a baby. It's my baby. It's not her husband's baby. Oh, all these things I've done. And that's just in the last, few months. But a humble and contrite heart. This guy lifts his heart up in humility, in guilt and shame. Because I can't even look at him. I can't even look up. But I know that he knows what's in my heart. 1 Samuel. God tells Samuel, go to Jesse's house in Bethlehem and you're going to anoint the new king. Jesse's got 8 boys. 7 of them are in the house. The 8th one's David. He's out with the sheep. First guy comes in and he's really tall and handsome and strong and he's dressed nice. And Samuel says, oh, it's got to be this guy. God says, nope. He says, you're looking at the outward appearance and I see his heart. You can't see his heart. I can see his heart. Not him. Not him. Not him. You got any other boys? Well, there's just David out there taking care of the sheep. Go get him. And God says, here's a man after my own heart. Same guy who's wailing and writing Psalm 51 after doing all these horrible things. He's a man after God's own heart. The guy who's big, strong, and handsome and holy-looking is not. This guy knows he has guilt and shame. He's burdened by sin. And he's certainly not confident and bold like the other guy. There's nothing confident about him, nothing bold about him. And he beats his breast over and over again. The Greek there means over and over again he does it. In ancient times, people thought your heart is where your emotions were. They didn't realize their heart was just a water pump. Nobody knew blood circulated until the 1600s, believe it or not. It's pretty hard to believe. But your heart was the seat of the emotions. That's why you always say, you broke my heart, or I gave my heart to her, or I did that. You always have this idea of heart, because that's where they thought the emotions were. And so, when you repented, you beat your chest because you're like punishing your heart. Because even Jesus said, evil things come out of your heart, not what you eat. You're not going to be damned because you have a pork chop. You're going to be damned because of the evil things that come out of your heart. Greed and lust and power and injustice. All these things come out of your heart. Now, we know what he means. They come out of your mind because your heart's just pumping. Your heart doesn't have any emotions, although your heart does have a little nervous system within it. But he knows the sin comes from his evil heart, and he knows he's been rebellious. So he beats his chest over and over again, as opposed to the other guy. Psalm 109, also written by David. For I am poor and needy, and my heart is wounded within me. I am gone like a shadow when it lengthens. I am shaken off like a locust. My knees are weak through fasting, and my flesh is feeble from lack of fatness. I also have become a reproach to them. When they look at me, they shake their heads. And this kind of fits this too. The Pharisees go, look at that guy. What's he even doing in here? Who even let him in the temple? What's he doing in here? The temple's supposed to be for cool people. That's why the one song we sang that has the Hebrew Baruch Haba B'Shem Adonai, that means blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. You know, when they were giving, at the very end, they're basically telling Yeshua, Jesus, what are you even doing here? Has any prophet ever come from Galilee? Who do you think you are? And after he tells them who he is, he says, you're not going to see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Which is going to happen soon. I hope it's tomorrow. And his prayer was very short. I mean, you can picture this guy was probably sighing and groaning, and while the other guy was boastfully shouting out his qualifications, this guy's calling himself a sinner. Probably groaning. He knows that he stands convicted. Now think about the New Testament implications of that. He knows he depends on the mercy of God. He knows he doesn't depend on his own holiness, his own righteousness. He doesn't have any merit to come and say, here I am, like the other guy did. He becomes a beggar. You've probably heard people say, you know, when you preach the gospel to somebody, when you evangelize and witness to somebody, you know, we're just beggars who know where the food is. You know, you're one beggar talking to another beggar. Hey, I know where the food is. Follow me. Not, oh, I was once a beggar like you, but now, look how holy I am. He knows he's guilty, and he knows he's dependent on grace. And he can't take this off of him himself. He's not going to be able to deal with his own sin, because he just can't do it. He has no merit, no argument of his own, no justification for the stuff he's done. Jesus says he's justified when he leaves. The other guy's not. The other guy's going to go back to his fancy Pharisee apartment or wherever he lived, and he's going to say to his wife, oh, you should have seen this schmuck I saw in the temple today. I can't believe they even let him in. Back in the, sitting in the back, he wasn't even looking up. Huh. But Jesus says, the guy who's in the back is justified. And the Greek words that are used there means he's just and righteous. Now, is he righteous? No. Is he just? No. He's been ripping people off at his job. But now Jesus says he's just and he's righteous. So the people standing outside the temple would applaud when the Pharisee comes out. Say, oh, here comes the holy guy. He's coming out of the temple. Yay. Yay for Mr. Pharisee. When the other guy came out of the temple, they said, what was he even doing in there? The guy's a tax collector. And why does your master eat with tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners? They ask the disciples that all the time. Why does he go to the home of a sinner? Right? His ways are so far above ours. Does this make any sense? You would think the Pharisee would be the guy who's justified because he's done all the stuff. But Jesus says, no, the other guy's justified. So how does this apply to us? How can we believe this? This is the gospel, right? How can we believe this? It doesn't make sense to us. It isn't logical. Nothing about the gospel is logical. Remember the parable of the guys who were working in the vineyard? And some guys go start working at 7 o'clock in the morning. Some guys start at 4:30. At 5 o'clock they quit. Everybody gets the same wage. You say, wait a minute. The people that started in the morning said, hey, wait a minute. We've been out here working in the sun all day. These guys have been out there a half hour. And the owner says, I can pay anybody however much I want. The older brother says, why is there a party for him? The party should be for me. I'm the righteous one. How can we believe this? It's counterintuitive to how we live. It goes against our common sense. The Pharisee's up here with a lot of status, and he's very scrupulous about what he does. So if you give him a dollar, he's going to give a dime back to the temple. If you give him a dollar and 2 cents, he's going to be conflicted about how to make a tenth of that. But he's going to, whatever it takes, if somebody brings him a bushel of grain and says, here, I got this for you, because you're so holy and so awesome, he's going to give a tenth of the grain into the temple treasury. Because he's scrupulous. If the service starts at 10, he's there at 2 minutes before 10. Cursing the people that come in at 2 minutes after 10. Because he's scrupulous. But we go somewhere greater than the temple. You know, Jesus himself said, yet I say to you that in this place, he's standing in the temple. He says, in this place, there's one greater than the temple. Matthew 12:6. He's greater than the temple. Remember when Mary and Joseph had to take little baby Jesus to Egypt? Nobody knows how long they were there or where exactly they were. If you go to the Coptic Orthodox Church on Pleasant Valley, they have this whole thing about, they're Egyptians, they have this whole thing about where they were in Egypt, how long they spent in each place, all based on their traditions. I mean, it's kind of cool, but you have no way to prove that that's true. And you don't find it in the scriptures, obviously. But they were away from the temple for some amount of time. So then when you think about it, they couldn't keep the law while they were there. They couldn't go to the temple. But guess who was with them? One greater than the temple. He says, one greater than the temple is here. So these two guys are praying at the real temple, the stone and wood temple. One repents, the other one doesn't. We approach the cross, one greater than the temple, who's on the cross, with this great sacrifice, the ultimate blood atonement, once for all. Right, this is the book of Hebrews in a nutshell. The sacrifice is once for all. How do we approach? Well, if you're the Pharisee, you go to the cross and say, I'm here, and you should be happy that I'm here because I'm a really important guy, and, you know, my appointment book today is, like, full. And I'm, like, third in command of all the Pharisees. There's only two of them ahead of me, and I do all the stuff. And somebody just gave me a bushel of wheat, and I took a tenth of a bushel of wheat to the treasury. And so then I thought I'd come over here and just, you know, let you know everything's cool. So you should be happy. I don't want to hear any condemnation. Or do you approach the cross like the publican, where you're on your knees wailing and crying and say, have mercy on me because I'm a disaster? Why don't people accept the gospel today? Because they don't know they're a disaster. They got nice houses. They got nice stuff in their house. They got plenty of food. They got ways to entertain themselves. They take pills so that all their medical problems will be better. And they got a culture that says, hey, whatever you want to do, just go do it. What do you need a savior for? In that case, everything's fine. Just like the Pharisee, everything's fine. But you have to approach like the publican because you're a disaster. Because you don't have any merits of your own. You don't go with pride if you don't have any merits of your own. You don't go with pride if you're a convict and you go before the judge and say, hey, judge, let me tell you, I'm pretty awesome. No, you're a convict. You're going to prison. And that's where we all stand condemned. The Pharisee doesn't realize he's condemned. He's congratulating himself. You don't congratulate yourself standing at the foot of the cross. The ground is level, as a lot of people say. At the foot of the cross, the ground is level. It's not people higher than other people. And you don't go to the cross to discuss how awesome you are. Oh, last night we did the Bible study, and then this morning we had a really nice service that I did. And then later this afternoon, I'm doing another service, and because I'm so awesome, I do, you know, a lot of stuff during the week, and I'm leading the prayers, and I'm studying the this, and I'm leading the group that's doing that, and tithing everything, mind you, and I follow every dietary law, every other law, every jot and tittle of the law, the old King James. So, let's face it, Lord, I'm pretty awesome. We're not there to discuss how awesome we are. And we're not there to tell him how glad he should be that we're there. Like this guy was. Oh, Lord, you should be happy I'm here. I don't even have to come here. I do all the stuff. The other guy's got sorrow, guilt, repentance, fear, and trembling. So when we go to the cross, what happens? We're thankful because we're overwhelmed by grace, not overwhelmed by all the stuff we do. Not thankful that he made us not like that guy. Guy says, thank you for not making me like him. The men who pray, I thank you, Lord, that you didn't make me a woman. I thank you that you let me do all this cool stuff. That's not being overwhelmed by grace. And that's not being thankful for the grace that you do get and the mercy that you do get. So when Jesus says the humble guy who's standing in the back is the one who's justified, this is because this is how he approaches the cross, even though he doesn't know about the cross yet. As opposed to the, quote, holy guy. Well, maybe, you know, I've said way more prayers than him, and my prayers have been a lot longer than his. And I think I've lit about 20,000 candles in my life. I think he's probably lit two. And look what he's wearing. I got all this cool stuff on. And look at him. You know, the interesting thing I think about the prodigal son, and since I referenced it, I'll say this, is, you know, when that kid goes home and he's been living with the pigs. I mean, can you imagine a Jewish boy living with pigs? And Jesus uses that as the message because he knows that the guys listening to him are going, ugh, there's nothing more sickening than living with the pigs. When this guy comes and he's practiced his confession, you know, well, I'm just going to tell my father. The father doesn't say to him, go take a shower, go shave, clean yourself up, put on some clothes, and then we'll talk. He puts the robes, the ring, the shoes right over his smelliness. Because he's humble and he's coming back and the father's waiting for him. The father's not waiting for Pharisees. He'd like to have him come. But he's not waiting for Pharisees. Any questions?